May it please the court, Ms. Rittman. This court has held that a lawyer owes his clients the utmost duty of good faith and the highest degree of loyalty and devotion to his clients. The relationship between the lawyer and the client is fiduciary in nature. These obligations cannot be diminished or eliminated by the fact that the client is incarcerated or indigent, or by a claim that the lawyer carries an excessive caseload. In this case, it's undisputed that the respondent breached these ethical duties and responsibilities to numerous clients and engaged in professional misconduct by habitually failing to diligently and promptly handle litigation on their behalf and by failing to reasonably communicate with his clients regarding their cases. The misconduct is exacerbated by the fact that respondent has been previously admonished by the informant on three occasions for the same violations that are present here, a lack of diligence and a lack of communication in representing clients. Respondent works for the Missouri Public Defender System. His primary work is in representing indigent clients who have filed pro se motions for post-conviction relief under Rule 29.15. Per that rule, appointed counsel must either file an amended motion for post-conviction relief or a statement in lieu of an amended motion. The determination as to whether and what type of pleading to file is generally made after appointed counsel has reviewed the file and appropriate records, communicated with the client, and completed any necessary investigation. Respondent was charged with professional misconduct in representing six of his clients during the period from 2011 to 2013. While the relevant dates and specific facts differ slightly from client to client, they all follow the identical factual pattern of misconduct. In each case, the public defender's office and ultimately respondent were appointed to represent movements who had filed pro se motions for PCR relief under Rule 29.15. After entering his appearance and obtaining an extension, respondent engaged in misconduct by neglecting the case, failing to reasonably communicate with his client, and ultimately failing to file either an amended motion for post-conviction relief or a statement in lieu. In each case, respondent was found to have abandoned the client by the trial court, and a new public defender assigned to the matter was able to file an amended motion out of time. It's undisputed that this misconduct violated the rules regarding diligence and communication. The key issue before this court is what is the appropriate sanction. The ABA standards on which this court regularly relies tells us that lack of diligence when it is knowing, standard 4.42, calls for suspension. A lawyer who knowingly fails to perform services on behalf of a client and causes either injury or potential injury, or when a lawyer engages in a pattern of misconduct that either causes injury or potential injury, is in violation of standard 4.42. Both of those elements of that standard have been met in this case. Six of respondents' clients were deprived of necessary and appropriate legal services due to respondents' neglect of their cases. Respondent failed to review appropriate records, failed to adequately communicate with his clients, failed to complete investigations of their cases, and ultimately failed to file the required amended motion or statement in lieu. The next question we ask after determining what the baseline standard is under the ABA standards is what's the state of mind present in the case. Informant believes the respondent's state of mind was clearly knowing. He acted with a conscious awareness of the nature and circumstances of the misconduct. In addition, there's a pattern of neglect present throughout the case that triggers the 4.42 standard. Arguably, there's no injury that has occurred to these clients whose cases were neglected. Each of the clients was ultimately permitted to file amended motions, and as of the date of the hearing, none of those amended motions were granted by the trial court. I believe at this point in time, one of those cases is on appeal, but none of the clients has been granted any relief under 29.15. Nonetheless, there was a potential for injury as a result of the neglect. If any of the clients' Rule 29.15 motions had, in fact, been meritorious, then their relief was delayed and they were placed in jeopardy by the fact that respondent neglected their cases. There are aggravators and mitigators that the court regularly looks at after determining the standard violated, the state of mind, and the injury or potential injury to the clients. In aggravation, informant would point out the respondent has a prior disciplinary history involving neglect and communication, the very same violations present here. There's a pattern of misconduct. There are multiple offenses, and the victims in this case are vulnerable. In mitigation, respondent has fully and freely disclosed any information that we have asked for. He's been cooperative with the disciplinary proceedings. He's been remorseful, and he suffers from a physical disability. Respondent argues that there's an excessive caseload present in this case. The respondent's caseload on 29.15 cases, as well as other cases, was excessive. He claims in his brief that he's trapped by a system in which the public defender's office and he cannot reject a case assignment on behalf of an indigent client unless a conflict of interest exists. He thought he would be fired if he refused additional cases. Respondent points out that various studies have concluded that the public defender system has more cases than they can handle, and the requests for relief have only been minimally successful. The apparent point of these assertions is that the court should treat an excessive caseload as a mitigating factor, if not an outright defense, in this case and in any case involving a public defender who neglects client matters. This court in the Pratt case declined to create an exception in the ethics rules for overworked lawyers who represent indigent persons charged with crimes.
But the fact that Pratt didn't create an exception and doesn't say, okay, the rules don't apply to you, doesn't mean the circumstances in which you find yourself are not relevant, though, does it? And if he rightly or wrongly believed there was nothing he could do about this and he was trying to do his best, isn't that relevant to intent and relevant to the other factors that you've mentioned to us? What are you saying? It has no relevance, it sounds like, as opposed to Pratt's saying it's not dispositive, it doesn't change his standard that he has to apply, but why doesn't that affect that he was so overburdened and overworked that he wasn't making good decisions about this, and that was a position he should not have put himself in, but he fell caught between a rock and a hard place? Is that not part of our analysis of the case?
It may be part of the court's analysis. It's not part of our analysis.
Why isn't that relevant?
Because in our view, there's an obligation to comply with Rule 4 in all its regards.
Yeah. And we've got violations and so forth, but we're looking at mitigators and aggravators as to sanctions. Why isn't it relevant?
To me, it's not a recognized mitigator. The Pratt decision, while it isn't a discipline case, clearly said that the court was not going to cut out an exception under Rule 4 for lawyers in this situation. The ABA opinion in this regard, 06-441 from 2006, went further and said that it's the obligation of the attorney to reduce their caseload so that they can handle all their cases in compliance with the ethics rules, and it even went further to say that the supervising attorney has an obligation to make sure that that attorney's caseload is
right.
Appropriate. So in my view, there is no exception, and the diligence.
But again, I didn't ask about an exception.
Well, and in our view, it doesn't come into play. I just would not, and I don't think you can take it into account, Judge Stitt. I mean, you know, it becomes a very, to me, slippery slope if you're going to take that into account for a public defender who's maybe has or claims to have an excessive caseload. Where are you going to draw that line for other attorneys who have a lot of cases? Cases where they represent pro se clients. I mean, maybe not in the public defender system, but what about a private attorney who has a load of pro bono cases they handle? Are we going to carve out an exception for them and not even an exception, simply take into account their caseload? I would say no. What about, if you're going to take the next step, what about prosecutors who have heavy caseloads? Are we going to take that into account, the fact that they have that caseload, in the fact that they missed a timeline or a deadline? What about just any attorney who has a lot of clients? Are we going to carve out an exception or even take into account the fact that they are carrying this caseload? In our view, within the discipline system at least, we cannot do that because it does become a very slippery slope as to where you're going to draw that line. So in our view, the Pratt decision was correct. The ABA opinion in that regard was absolutely correct, that there should not be any consideration given to that caseload in determining either in mitigation or otherwise in terms of violation, whether there's been a violation of the rule.
Can you address the IEP?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So I think the EIP, the Employee Improvement Plan, is very important for this court to look at. It's found in Informants Exhibit 10, Volume 4, in the record, pages 795 to 797. And the reason it's so important is because it is a contemporaneous document that will show this court at least what the public defender system was thinking of respondents' performance at the time that that performance was deficient. On September 4, 2014, they issued an EIP to the respondent telling him that his performance was deficient and it required immediate, sustained, and significant improvement in order for his employment to continue. It went on to mention the fact that he could not miss deadlines for filing 29.15 amended motions and statements in lieu. He had to maintain regular communications with his clients, and that he must timely make all scheduled court appointments. The interesting thing about the EIP is it gives no solace or relief or support to the respondent based on claimed excessive caseload. There's no mention in that three-page document about caseloads. And in addition, there's no mention in that document about respondent's health problems, which there is a sufficient record that he was having some hospitalizations during this time. There's no doubt about it. And I think it is a mitigator. It's for this court to decide to what extent it mitigates the misconduct. But I think it's at least noteworthy that that EIP makes no mention, the employer makes no mention of either of those factors. They simply write him up for deficient performance in his job duties. So I think that is something that, because it's contemporaneous, it came directly from the district defender, is of relevance to this court.
And are you recommending a state suspension or a suspension, and for how long in either case?
Our recommendation, based on our balancing of mitigators and aggravators, is for an indefinite suspension of a year. In other words, an actual suspension, indefinite, with no leave to apply for reinstatement for 1 year.
In the respondent's brief, the respondent mentions that whilst hospitalized and suffering from an illness, he continued to work 50 hours a week, that he had the heaviest caseload for the public defenders and the more complicated cases. Do you dispute that?
Not at all. I think that that's undisputed testimony from his supervisor. The one thing I will note, Judge Breckenridge, is that in all of these hospitalizations except for one, the missed deadlines occurred months after the hospitalizations ended. If you look at the timelines, they're contained in respondent's brief. The timelines for filing these amended motions or statements in lieu go from 3 months to 8 months after the hospitalizations had ended. So we do not dispute that he was working well in the hospital. What we dispute is that he wasn't. The other thing you should know is he, in five of these six cases, he didn't even communicate with the client until the deadline for filing the statement in lieu or the amended motion had passed. I don't know that hospitalizations excuse that type of misconduct. Thank you.
Changed since your agreement to accept the probation recommended by the DHP?
Excuse me, Patrick.
What has changed between now and the time you accepted the recommendation of probation?
I don't believe we accepted the recommendation.
But
I think we rejected the panel's recommendation. I'll check that, but I'm almost certain we did, because I will tell you that because of the injection of the issue of excessive caseloads, I didn't think that we could accept it. I think that was something we had to bring up to the court so that you all could consider that, because I didn't want that hanging out there as a possible something that someone would point to if the court happened to accept the panel's recommendation without us
The information was filed 3 years after the last conduct, which was 4 years ago. What's the significance to us of that?
I think what it shows is that he hasn't had any further problems with
so for 4 years he hasn't had.
Not to our knowledge. That's correct.
So if someone four years ago had serious misconduct, but during the last 4 years has functioned properly and appropriately, What is the benefit to the profession to impose a suspension at this point?
I'm not sure what changed circumstances have occurred with regard to his practice, to what extent his workload has been lessened because of all this. All I can say is that we judged it based on the conduct at the time and what we thought was appropriate. I agree that there has been this period of time of where we haven't had these same types of issues arise. So that is, I think, something that the court can take into account.
One of the concerns is whether if we continue him in the practice of law, he's a danger to public or to his clients.
Correct.
And looking at that time period and the lack of problems, it does not appear the record would support a need to suspend him for purposes of
and if the court decides that the mitigators are such, especially the physical disability is such that it should be mitigated to probation, we have no problem with it. I think it's important that the court frankly make clear that any mitigation is based on that disability and the fact that he was suffering from that during the period that he was deficient in these operations, and it doesn't relate to excessive caseload. That's why I thought it was necessary to bring it up to you all, because I didn't want any kind of memorandum order, frankly, hanging out there that someone would point to and say, well, here it is, excessive caseload's enough to mitigate.
Normally the reason for suspension, or part of the reason, is to protect the public. And in light of that 4 years, that wouldn't be a reason. So not to stay it, in other words.
No, and I'm not arguing. In other words, I think the standard is met for suspension. I think that the EIP shows that the employer themselves didn't consider the physical issues. We all went through that. Informant has no problem with probation and monitoring conduct for a period of time. I agree that this period of 4 years since this conduct is relevant.
Is that for purposes of whether somebody is deserving of probation as opposed to a hard suspension? It's not unlike an alcohol or drug abuse problem that if we knew contemporaneous, we would have suspended them, but has demonstrated a period of recovery where they might deserve probation with the suspension.
Correct. I mean, in other words, I think it's still worthy of some sort of additional monitoring pursuant to state suspension with probation. I agree.
Thank you. Counsel, when you come up on rebuttal, the paper rattling up here indicates that we thought there was an acceptance by the OCDC.
Outlook.
So you might want to check to the Outlook. And,
yes.
And if there was, then address Judge Stitt's question about what.
I'll take a look at that. Thank you, Judge Wilson.
Hey, please, the court. And in fact, informant's brief at page 8 states that they did accept the probation recommendation and cites portion of the record. So
did
give you a head start. The problems that occurred in this case resulted from an attorney with severe and chronic physical health problems coupled with a broken public defender system. These were matters outside his control. He had no viable options. The public defender system is a unique system. It's not comparable to a prosecutor's.
How is it any different than a young associate in a big firm who's overly burdened with work and has the choice between competently following the rules of profession or quitting and going somewhere else? How is it any different?
Well, the firm, number one, has the ability to turn away cases. And so
and maybe that's the reason why we don't discipline the entire firm or the entire public defender system. Here, we have to look at these cases individually. And I see a big problem that doesn't just affect what you're talking about today if we allow attorneys to say, my boss made me do it. Because when they take the oath to follow the rules of professional responsibility, sometimes that means not taking a case, and sometimes that means taking a different job.
And quitting would have been apparently the option that Mr. Hinkebein felt like he had. He felt that if he...
Well, or if you're a young attorney and your boss asks you to do something unethical.
Sometimes
that's what you have to do.
And I have told attorneys to do that. But let's ask here, as compared with those cases, what would be the benefit to the public and the system of an attorney who had been practicing in this area for many years, who was a top performer for the office, who was filing the most cases, was recognized for his creativity and high ability in being able to serve these clients?
Well, there seems to me that there is a lot that could have been done between quitting and not serving that population, where he could have said, I've got a bigger caseload, I have more complex cases, I'm suffering from a serious illness, I need to not take a heavier load than other people, or I am missing deadlines. I mean, that the fear that they might not like that and there might be some retribution, I question that that's reasonable, but that's a long way from saying, I've just got to quit.
Well, but everything that you were suggesting that he might have said to them, he knew that they knew. Although he did not know that he was being piled on with a higher caseload than everyone else until we got to the hearings and things like that in this case.
But Mr. Bertman, I mean, are you indeed saying that Pratt is wrong and we have to have a different standard for public interest lawyers than we have for privately retained attorneys? Or are you saying this is relevant to a state of mind and therefore to discipline?
I think it's relevant to discipline. I am not arguing. I know people who would argue that this should be exonerate him from any disciplinary violations. We have not argued that at any point. He is a person who is very dedicated to his clients, and he feels very remorseful that these clients slipped past him in the hundreds.
Wasn't that a mistake of judgment on his part not to fight back? We all understand the pressures he would have felt, but you've explained very well, but is that acceptable to not say anything because you think you'll be rejected as opposed to trying that?
I think it would have been helpful had he said something, certainly at this point. It would be nice to be able to say that he'd said something. But his supervisor, to whom he would have said something, testified at the hearing that even if he had said something, the supervisor would felt that there was nothing he could have done.
Well, that might be a problem for the supervisor for condoning ineffective assistance, if he actually told him he was not filing things that were required by law to be filed. But
doesn't the EIP, though, cut against this? Doesn't that suggest that they thought he had other choices, including that he could perform adequately?
I don't believe so at all. I think the EIP was not written for this proceeding. It was written as an internal document there. And what you need to realize, and the record clearly establishes, that many other things happened in conjunction with when this EIP was entered. One, he was provided additional secretarial support specifically related to calendaring. There's only one full-time secretary for everybody working in that office. He was given a little bit more of the assistance of that person. His supervisor testified he actually began monitoring Mr. Hinkebein's caseload at that point. That's when
he
began.
Why did this all happen then, but it wouldn't have happened if he'd brought it up himself earlier?
Because a supervisor was aware of the circumstances that
a complaint.
And he still missed two deadlines after that. Is that right?
Right. I'm sorry, after the EIP.
Yeah.
I don't think OCDC has not been arguing that those were truly missed deadlines. They were barely missed deadlines. One was like he was doing e-filing and like midnight came and he missed the date. And then another one where he thought the e-filing, or he thought that maybe the secretary had done something that had gone through on e-filing, and he gets to court and finds out that it hadn't been filed when he believed it had been filed. So those are very different situations than what we've got here.
How do we know if he gets overburdened again, he won't do the same thing? What procedures are in place to protect the clients?
Well, and as I said, there are a number of things that happened in conjunction with the EIP. The monitoring of his caseload was changed. The nature of his caseload so that he wasn't being assigned all the complex cases. He was given some that were less complex, and his caseload was slightly reduced. And very significantly, the EIP was entered into in 2014. That is also the point at which his health stabilized. And so all of those factors, more than an EIP that just set standards and really did not do much else, are really what has caused the change in his ability to manage his caseload. He has been doing fine since then. He is feeling well these days. Although he continues to have the chronic health problems, I want to emphasize that contrary to what Mr. Pratzel's argument would indicate, the hospitalizations are not the whole story here. He has very chronic health problems that continued to have him ill in between hospitalizations. During this entire period, you would say he believes, I believe the medical records establish that he was suffering from physical disabilities due to these chronic and sometimes on several occasions life-threatening health problems that he encountered during this period of time when these problems occurred.
So you're basically, the caseload standard was too great for his physical condition as opposed to some theoretical too great. His physical condition was a large part of the reason why he couldn't handle his caseload.
Yes. Our assertion is, I mean, the workload, I think, is a factor here that the court should take into consideration. But I think even if he had been working someplace else, with the health problems that he had, and with his supervisor's knowledge of the health problems, the supervisor is carrying files back and forth to him when he's in the hospital. With that situation, I believe that the mitigating factors are compelling that the court should see that this is a person who was trying his best to do everything he could for these clients. He testified that he always put forth his best effort. He could have probably filed these things and just gotten it done, and nobody would have known that it was less than his best effort. But unfortunately, you know, that didn't happen for him at this point. But he was doing the best that he could under unreasonable circumstances, and I believe that those are very compelling mitigating factors that this court should take into consideration.
What about aggravating factors such as, you know, he's had three prior disciplines, three admonitions?
Has
that increased his sanction?
It is an aggravate. Those are certainly recognized aggravating factors. The last one was 7 years ago. They were spread over a period of time. Although they're aggravating factors, I believe they should be minimal aggravating factors in this situation. And the court goes with this idea of progressive discipline in many cases. And OCDC, the informant, is arguing for you to jump from admonition to full-on suspension. Well, there's a lot of room in between there for progressive discipline. And we're at this stage. We've never been at the stage where the Supreme Court was imposing discipline.
Well, but how many judicial abandonment findings, you know, how many abandonment cases did he have?
Well, each of these six were found to be abandonments.
Right. Spread over what period of time?
Over a several-year period of 2010 or 11 to 2013 or 14 is the period of time we're talking about.
You know, if those would have been brought to the attention of OCDC sooner, you don't think there would have been some discipline that occurred in between then and the multitude that eventually occurred?
It certainly is a possibility. You should realize that there was only one complaint, not six complaints in this case. The OCDC learned of the rest of the files from the respondent himself.
Would you agree, though, in the absence of any mitigators or aggravators, that this conduct would merit suspension, that we're in the right starting point with suspension?
I think when someone, and this is where I have to look at the caseload, when someone has more than they can possibly do, and they know that there's something out there.
You said that's a mitigator, that it's not a defense. So I'm saying, in the absence of that, somebody with a normal health and normal caseload and everything else, in the absence of aggravators or mitigators, that suspension for this sort of conduct would be the appropriate starting point.
If he just knows he's not doing it, and there's no reason that he can't do it, but he just still doesn't do it, perhaps we're at a suspension level then. One of the things
how many statute of limitations cases? How many statute of limitations cases, for example, would you expect a civil attorney to receive before they would receive a suspension? Do you think it would take six, spread over a course of years? If OCDC was promptly notified of each lung statute of limitations?
I think that is not exact analogy because of the fact that
they're covered by the same ethical rule. So what makes it an inappropriate analogy?
Because in statute of limitations, that's it. If the other side raises it, that's it. In these cases, you look at the appellate cases coming out, routinely abandonment occurs in PCR cases. And his experience was that many times, for both him and others, a deadline had been missed. And they filed a motion to allow them to file it out of time, and that was routinely granted. In fact, always granted, except in a situation where it was the result of the client's conduct. So it's not a situation where you know, okay, I missed a statute of limitations, and we are out of luck.
It's more like filing your answer on time and getting leave to file it out of time.
Closer to something like that. I mean, I think probably the PCR system itself is broken because of the deadlines that it sets and then the way that they are routinely ignored. But that's that story for another day.
Are you sure you've got 90 seconds left?
Tell us how to fix that.
I can fix the PCR system in 90 seconds, I'm sure. We believe that a suspension would be a clearly excessive discipline for this individual attorney under this attorney's circumstances. And at whatever level you want to consider the various circumstances, that's certainly within the court's parameters and prerogative, but we believe an actual suspension would be clearly excessive. He knew that he had these cases, but he also had hundreds of other cases he was handling properly. We believe it falls under a negligence standard, failure to heed under the ABA standards, and that, therefore, a reprimand is the appropriate discipline. The cases cited by the informant are not appropriate. This case involves an attorney who was physically broken, working in a system that was broken. He had no control over his caseload. Perhaps he should have said something. The evidence is that wouldn't have made a difference. We shouldn't overlook the things that were out of his control, and he should receive no more than a reprimand under all of the circumstances in this case in light of the mitigating factors which are compelling, especially involving his health. Thank you.
May it please the court, first let me apologize. You're all right. You shouldn't have had to rustle your papers. We accepted the panel's recommendation of probation. The court then, in February of this year, ordered the case briefed and argued. We now ask for suspension. The difference largely was based on my review of the EIP, the fact that the employer themselves sanctioned this respondent irrespective of physical and caseload issues, and was simply for deficient performance. And while we believe that under any scenario, standard 4.42 is the baseline, a suspension baseline, we also understand that if the court believes that the physical disability was such a mitigator that it mitigates it to a probation, we think that that should be a state suspension with probation. We certainly don't agree with a reprimand. We think that this respondent needs to be monitored at the very least for a period of time. I'm sure his own employer is monitoring his caseload, but not caseload, but performance. And we would want to do the same in terms of going forward with performance of legal duties on behalf of his clients.
Mr. Pratzel, sorry to interrupt, but I understand your concern about recognizing a mitigator of caseload. I share some of your very concerns about that being a slippery slope. But the fact that we're dealing with a public servant who isn't involved in financial success, this lack of diligence didn't result in his padding his pockets in a certain way. And doesn't that go to some other mitigators that the ABA recognized, such as lack of selfish motive, character, and those type of things that we could potentially lump some of that into?
I would not make that leap, Judge Powell, in terms of it being a lack of selfish motive. Clearly, I think there was no selfish motive here. It's not an aggravator in this case. I think that the failings of this respondent are the same failings of any attorney, public servant or not,
who neglects their cases for whatever reason, and to dilute or weaken the rules by saying, well, because this person's a public servant who has a lot of cases, we're going to apply a different diligence and communication standard, I think would be wrong, and I think would be jumped on by a lot of other attorneys for extending that to them as well. I just don't think it applies. The ABA opinion clearly says it doesn't apply. This court's decision in Pratt clearly did not carve out an exception under Rule 4 for these types of public servants, and I don't think it applies in this case. And I just think that you know, I'm glad we're here arguing the case, because if there is going to be mitigation, I think it should be based on physical disability and should be mitigated to a state suspension with probation.
Thank you. It's a well-argued case.